about is the rate of sea level rise. Now, as you've pointed out there, the rate of sea level rise has increased very rapidly over the last few decades. It's now at about 4.5 millimetres per year. And when you talk in millimetres, I think people's eyes glaze over and they think that's a small number. But if you look at the recent increase or the recent acceleration, and you were to just, you know, not kind of necessarily add to that, but actually just extrapolate that trend through the rest of this century, and you start to hit 6.5 millimetres in the 2050s. But before the end of the century, we hit 10 millimetres per year. So that obviously is centimetre per year. Now, a centimetre per year is 1 metre per century. So there are a generation, our children's generation, if you like, who when they're in their 80s and 90s, are likely to be experiencing sea level rise that is 10 millimetres per year, and their children are going to have to cope potentially with rates of sea level rise that are 1 metre per century. And one of the things we point out in our research is that once you exceed about 1 centimetre per year, that's when things become really difficult to adapt to. That's where really your simplest and easiest adaptation is simply to move people inland. You cannot really defend against sea level rise that's 1 metre per century.
Yes, we always took that sea level was some sort of stable that we could measure from, and now our grandchildren will always assume that the sea is always rising, and that's going to be a very strange world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, we know from looking at times in the Earth's past that actually sea level has varied quite dramatically. I think one of the really worrying things that the past tells us is that the last time that greenhouse gas contributions, carbon dioxide contributions, for example, were as high as they are today, sea level globally could have been somewhere between 10 and 20 metres higher. So we know that there's been natural climate variations in the past that have been slow, driven by changes in the way that the Earth orbits the sun. But we know that just really small changes in temperature can have a huge effect on sea level. And we've seen that in the past. Now, of course, what we're doing at the moment is we're artificially warming the planet more quickly than it's ever been warmed in the past due to natural variations. And so it's very simple physics and very simple science to infer that actually we are now heading for some quite rapid increases in sea level and sea level rise.
After some reading and interviews, my take is that Greenland glaciers may predominate in sea level rise in the first stages, like coming decades, and then Antarctica. But what does the science say?
Well, you've got a very good understanding there. So when we think about the melting of ice on land, and which will kind of melt first and quickest, and then which will come next, then it's those small mountain glaciers and ice caps that will be first to go. So these are the glaciers in the tropics. You know, we heard earlier in the year that Venezuela, for example, has now lost all of its mountain glaciers. You've got glaciers on every continent, and they're melting very rapidly. But if all of the mountain glaciers around the world, and there are 275,000 of them, I should add, if all of those were to melt overnight, they would only increase sea level by about 32 centimetres. And that's something we could probably cope with and we could probably adapt to. What we're really worried about are the bigger ice sheets, as we call them, as glaciologists call them, in Greenland and in Antarctica. And Greenland, the island, is pretty much covered by a thick ice sheet that locks up about just over 7 metres of sea level equivalent. And in Antarctica, we've got an ice sheet that stores somewhere around 58 metres of sea level equivalent. So if you're worried about sea level rise, then you really need to be looking at Greenland and Antarctica. And Antarctica is, you know, it's obviously in the southern hemisphere, it's at the South Pole, it's a huge continent, but it's very, very cold. And so you're right to suggest that Greenland is what we're most worried about. In fact, if we look at our measurements of Greenland, we know it's contributing far more to sea level rise currently than Antarctica. And because it's situated slightly further south, it's almost a mid-latitude ice sheet. And in some ways, you know, it shouldn't really be there, given the warming that we've experienced. But what we're worried about now is that it's going to tip over some threshold then it's going to start melting much more rapidly than it is. But it's dominated the contribution to sea level over Antarctica. Antarctica, we're also very worried about from a slightly different reason. So Greenland gets attacked by both warm atmospheric temperatures and by warm ocean temperatures that melt its floating portions. In Antarctica, we don't see so much atmospheric melting. It's so cold down there. The air is so dry, it's so cold. You don't tend to get too much melting of the ice from above, from atmospheric warming. But what you do get around Antarctica is ocean warming. And we're really quite worried about ocean warming in Antarctica because we're seeing warm ocean currents, what we say intruding, washing up, if you like, underneath the floating parts of Antarctica. And they might trigger some kind of instability on timescales of maybe within this century, but more likely take place next century. So you're absolutely right. It'll be the small mountain glaciers that will go first, and we're seeing them vanish before our eyes at the moment. Then Greenland, which is now undergoing some very dramatic changes. And then the Antarctic contribution to sea level is likely to kick in the next century. But if you've got, at that point, Greenland melting and Antarctica melting, that's when you're hitting those rates of sea level rise that could be in excess of a centimetre per year.
And we've learned a lot more about past climates and ice in recent decades. Can you tell us about possible Earth parallels long ago that help us understand our own climate future?
So one of the things that we've done in our research is we've looked at past warm periods as an analogue for what might happen in the future. And it's actually really worrying. So, for example, the last time the Earth was kind of as warm as present, say between 1 and 1.5 degrees above those pre-industrial temperatures from the 1800s, it's an interglacial period. It's a warm period about 125,000 years ago. We know that temperatures were the same, but actually greenhouse gas concentrations were much, much lower. But if we look at the sea level record from that time, sea levels were somewhere between 2 and 9 meters higher than present. So what that tells us really clearly is that if you warm the Earth by 1 to 1.5 degrees, which is exactly what we're doing, we're at about 1.2 to 1.3 degrees of warming at the moment above pre-industrial, we're committing ourselves to 2 to 9 meters of sea level rise. If we go back to another warm period, if we go back three and a bit million years to the mid-Pliocene, again, temperatures were probably just a bit warmer than present, but the carbon dioxide concentrations were 450 parts per million, so a little bit higher than present. So we use that mid-Pliocene warm period as an analogue for where we might be later this century. And that's when we see several metres of sea level rise, 10 to 20 metres, possibly higher than 20 metres of sea level rise at those temperatures and at those greenhouse gas concentrations that we're heading at. So again, these paint a very worrying picture because they say that, you know, if you play around with just a few fractions of a degree or just, you know, a few tens of parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, then you get changes in the polar ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica that lead to multi-meter contributions to sea level rise. So we use those as analogues, and they tell a very clear picture. It's very difficult to see with, you know, any kind of optimism how we're not heading for several metres of sea level rise over the next few centuries. I mean, this has been known for some time. This is in the IPCC reports that have been released, you know, over the last few decades. But I think one of the things that the IPCC reports tended to be in some ways a little bit cautious is they've said, well, we're committed to this sea level rise. We're committed to maybe, I don't know, 5 to 9 meters of sea level rise. But hopefully it will take place over quite slow, adaptable timescales. So maybe 1,000 years timescales. But what we're seeing is such dramatic changes over the last decade or so that we're now thinking that we need to bring forward some of those estimates. And that's where those rates of sea level rise start to become quite worrying. Because I think what we're seeing, what we're observing, is that we're seeing things happen much more dramatically, much more concerningly than perhaps we thought maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years ago would happen. The pace of change has really accelerated in the last few decades.
Go back 25 years, scientists were not terribly worried about ice loss and sea level rise from massive East Antarctica. Sea ice was growing there, snow was accumulating, it was very cold. Should we reevaluate that?
Absolutely. You know, we call East Antarctica the sleeping giant. I mentioned that in Antarctica, it's the biggest ice mass on Earth. It stores about 58 metres of sea level equivalent volume, but the vast majority of that, you know, 52 metres of that, is actually locked up in East Antarctica. All of the changes we're seeing at the moment are from West Antarctica, and that in itself is worrying because West Antarctica could contribute somewhere of the order of, you know, 4 to 5 metres of sea level rise. But from a sea level perspective, if you're really interested in what the worst case scenario might be, it would be if we start to see mass change from East Antarctica. And I, you know, you can dig back into some of the older literature, some of the papers that were published in the 1980s and 1990s. There are papers out there saying it would take 17 degrees of warming to destabilize East Antarctica. And there are papers out there, as you've alluded to, that showed that East Antarctica was gaining mass, that, you know, it's probably mitigated sea level rise over the last century, because in a warmer atmosphere, we get more snowfall over East Antarctica. So it's ironic that some of the climate skeptics out there would often point to the fact that East Antarctica was growing, therefore climate change couldn't be happening. Actually, it was the opposite. East Antarctica was growing because climate change was happening, because of a warmer atmosphere, we were seeing increased snowfall, increased precipitation over East Antarctica. Now, one of the things that we've discovered over the last one or two decades is that actually, whilst there are still parts of East Antarctica that are gaining mass through enhanced snowfall, we're also starting to see warning signs of ice loss in East Antarctica. And we never thought we'd see this, you know, or at least, you know, going back 20 years or so, we would have been very surprised to see this. But we're seeing subtle changes in East Antarctica that we were seeing in West Antarctica 20, 25 years ago. So this is why we're worried, because at the moment, East Antarctica is kind of in balance. It's not contributed to sea level rise. Parts of it are gaining mass, parts of it are losing mass. But those parts that are losing mass are doing so through the same mechanisms that we've seen in West Antarctica. So, for example, we're seeing the ocean warming around East Antarctica. We're seeing the retreat of glaciers in East Antarctica linked or in the same locations as to where we're seeing the ocean warming. So we're inferring that the same changes that have been taking place in West Antarctica perhaps over the last two decades are just starting to emerge in parts of East Antarctica. And so we need to keep a really close eye on that ice sheet, because if that mass loss starts to outpace the mass gain from the increased snowfall, then, you know, as I said, the sea level potential from East Antarctica is much higher. And some of the, you know, research we've done on East Antarctica and the phrases we've used is that we really don't want to wake up this sleeping giant at the South Pole.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is professor and glaciologist Chris Stokes from Durham University. And now we get to the key message of your latest Nature article. You say 1.5 degrees of warming is not a safe limit, but actually far too high. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this is a tricky one. You know, this is not an easy message to put out there. But, you know, as scientists, we're trained and part of our job is to tell, you know, the truth, in the sense that, you know, just let the facts, let the observations speak for themselves. So just a little bit of context. If you go back to 2015 and the Conference of the Parties, or the COP at the time, COP21 in Paris, you know, there was a major landmark agreement signed at that COP in Paris in 2015. And that was where pretty much every country in the world signed an agreement to limit warming to 2 degrees above pre-industrial, and ideally to, in the words of that agreement, pursue efforts to limit warming to 1.5. And we're currently somewhere between 1.2 and 1.3 degrees of warming. So we've not got long to go before we hit that kind of, you know, that 1.5 lower limit, ambitious limit within the Paris Climate Agreement. And so there's been huge amounts of research aimed at showing, you know, the advantage of limiting warming to 1.5 rather than 2 degrees or rather than 3 degrees. There's been these calls that you see, you know, we must keep 1.5 alive, we must target 1.5, and that is absolutely something that, that we're fully supporting. But what the observations show from a sea level rise perspective is that 1.5 seems to be too high. The changes that we're observing, the changes that we think have taken place during past warm periods when Earth was at 1.5 degrees, the changes that are seen to take place when you run your computer models of these ice sheets at 1.5 degrees of warming shows that it will not stop sea level rise. That the best case scenario is that sea level rise will be slow and steady and on this kind of current trajectory that sees us hit 10 millimeters a year of sea level rise before the end of this century. That's the best case scenario. And so this is a bit of an unpalatable message, you might say, whether it's for the public or the policymakers. But what we're saying that is, if you're interested in sea level rise and you're concerned about sea level rise, we thought it was really important that the message gets out there from scientists that 1.5 is not going to solve this problem. That, you know, if we hit 1.5, in the best case scenario, we're still looking at some really dangerous rates of sea level rise. But when we wrote that paper and when we published that message, we didn't want to just stop there. You know, we didn't want to say, well, 1.5 won't be enough. The obvious question, if I was a policymaker and I've attended the last three Conference of the Parties or COP meetings, and I do speak to climate negotiators and policymakers, and the obvious question will be, well, okay, if you're saying 1.5 is too high, then what should we aim for? And now that is a really tricky question to answer, because we haven't actually run many computer simulations of Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheets at warming levels that are lower than present. But what we do in this paper is we do hypothesize, we think there is enough evidence out there to suggest that actually if you want to protect the ice sheets, if you want to somehow try and preserve the ice sheets and slow or ideally stop sea level rise from Greenland and Antarctica, you probably need to go back to about 1 degree of warming, possibly even lower. So, you know, that you could argue is a conversation for another day, but there is provision within the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. There is provision to review what's called the long-term temperature goal for planet Earth. And so whilst efforts at the moment are very much focused on trying to limit warming to 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial values, to do all we can to do that, to limit the warming, perhaps we're heading for a slight overshoot and then maybe coming back down to 1.5. If there is space in these negotiations to kind of take a kind of broader perspective and say, well, okay, what would be a safe temperature limit for Earth? Then actually I think most of the research, whether you're looking at kind of rainforests, sea level rise, ecosystem change, ocean health, 1 degree or below seems to be a much safer target for planet Earth, I would say. And you know what's really surprising, or perhaps not surprising? People wrote this in 1990s. Yeah, there are papers out there in the 1990s saying, whoa, we think climate warming's happening. A safe limit should be 1 degree. A safe limit for carbon dioxide concentration should be 350 parts per million. And of course, those kind of voices have been largely ignored. And so in some ways, we're just repeating that message that other scientists were pointing out, you know, almost three or four decades ago.
I'd like to read you a short quote from a brand new science from David Chandler and his Norwegian colleagues, and then get your take. They say, notably, West Antarctic ice sheet collapse contributes over 4 meters sea level rise in equilibrium ice sheet states with little, 0.25 degrees C, or even no ocean warming above present. Therefore, today we are likely at, or almost at, an overshoot scenario, supporting recent studies warning of substantial irreversible ice loss with little or no further climate warming. Chris, what do you think?
I think there's been a number of similar studies saying this. 10 years ago, there were a couple of papers came out in quick succession using numerical models with some observations showing that actually we may have passed the tipping point for West Antarctica, that we may have already triggered irreversible retreat that will essentially unfold over the next few decades, centuries, scale, where the it doesn't matter what we do to the climate, this thing has already now been triggered and there's nothing we can do to stop it. And those were kind of the only two papers, and scientists, I remember them being presented at conferences, and scientists would say, well, you're using a certain setup for your model and certain parameter range, and you know, this is not a unique problem, and you know, other models have since come along and said, okay, maybe we're okay, and then another model will come along and say, no, we've... But I would say that there's now more and more modelling studies creeping out, using different model setups, using slightly different forcings and parameter sets, that seem to show that this kind of tipping point, if it's not already happened, will certainly be triggered, even if we were to magically not warm the Earth anymore. And I think the same is true for Greenland as well. Actually, there are parts of Greenland that seem to have passed a threshold. And so if that is true, we may not know for a few more decades. Scientists might not be able to say with certainty, yes, now we've passed that point of no return, until it is well past its starting point, if you can see what I mean. So I would say there is a growing body of evidence that suggests that actually, even without further warming, the ice sheets in Greenland and West Antarctica are likely to tip into a state of irreversible retreat. And then, of course, our best-case scenario is that it unfolds slowly and steadily and becomes adaptable. Worst-case scenario, we're looking at maybe adding a metre by the end of the century, 2 metres during the next century, which, again, becomes almost impossible to adapt to, and the loss and damage, you know, goes into trillions of dollars.
And as you say, you've attended several climate COPs, the great climate conferences, as an observer, and you sometimes speak directly with national policymakers. Who is most interested in the ice sea level threat, and what do you advise?
Yeah, so it's very simple science, right? You know, the ice melts, the sea level goes up. This is not complicated science, but, you know, I would say that obviously the countries that are most concerned are those where most of their territory is within a few meters of sea level. So you immediately start to think of some of the South Pacific islands, Vanuatu, Tuvalu, the Marshall Islands, you know, those countries where almost their entire landmass is within a few meters and of sea level. And those countries, you know, they could be wiped off the map within a century or two. And that raises all kinds of interesting legal issues, as well as a kind of major humanitarian crisis. Those people will have to move to other territories, and what happens to their state, what happens to their nationality, etc., is a whole kind of legal area that we haven't got time to go into. But then there are other countries as well, you know, which have low-lying areas. You know, Bangladesh, for example, Indonesia, Jakarta, Shanghai in China, Florida in the US, the Netherlands in Europe. You know, almost any country with a coastline is going to be affected by sea level rise. And then you could argue that actually even landlocked countries, they're going to be affected, because we could be looking within a several decades to a century or so, we could be looking at some mass migration, so that even landlocked countries will not be immune from the effects of sea level rise. And so this is something that gains traction at these meetings. You know, people are worried about sea level rise, and it is a scientific area that is used in the negotiations as an example for taking or trying to take urgent action to address, you know, this warming. And our message has always been that, you know, every fraction of a degree matters. So, you know, if we don't make 1.5 and we hit 1.6, well, that will be better than 1.7. Which will be better than 1.9? Which will be better than 2.5? Anything we can do. This is why sometimes I try and move a little bit away from the kind of the tipping points and the temperature thresholds, because we don't know, if we're honest, exactly where they lie. But we do know that, as I said, 1.4 is better than 1.5. 1.5 is better than 1.6. And so we just need to get that message across that, you know, anything we can do to kind of, you know, decarbonize, to reach net zero, where we're not putting as much additional greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, will be helpful and will mean less damage, less loss, less financial outlay in the long term.
We have been speaking with scientist Chris R. Stokes. He is the lead author in the new paper, Warming of 1.5 degrees C is Too High for Polar Ice Sheets. That was published May 20th, 2025 in Communications, Earth and Environment. This is an open access article. It's free for you to read, and you should. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Chris, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Pleasure. Thank you for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Whatever circus politics in the stock market provide, wherever you hide in social media distractions or your favorite cable show, there is another reality with physics. Long cycles, the whole biological tapestry. The real world is getting hotter, the sea higher. Fires, flood, drought get more extreme. Does that sound like a cranky Old Testament prophet of doom? Sorry, it is reality, measured by careful minds with a system that controls our delusions as much as we can. It is science. And those are the rocks and the trees and the rivers and the currents of air out there. That is where we are truly alive. I'm Alex Smith. Radio EcoShock is listener-supported radio, and it's now 20 years on the air and not stopping. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Choking in the smoke, put on a mask. Strange, what is it? You don't have to ask when the dragon comes. It's just more fire, thunder in the heat. Another year hotter, not much sleep. Hook up the trailer, get out of town. Fire monster coming all around. It wasn't this bad in the old people's day. Kids looking sad. Will our home go away? Go ahead, build more pipelines. Go ahead, burn more gas until the dragon comes. Bites you on the bleed. Nothing on the up and up. Safety hard to find. We had a hope, we had a dream. Billionaires ate it all, hid behind the screen. I'm a dragon.
This is CJSF 90.1 FM. We stream on the internet at cjsf.ca.
This is Bird Note. We're approaching the summer solstice, the longest day of the year. In the northern reaches of Canada and Alaska, June days offer breeding birds almost continuous daylight. Here's one shorebird that breeds in the Arctic, the black-bellied plover. As you listen, imagine a bird with a dramatic black face, neck, and belly, a stark white head, and a speckled back. In late April and early May, black-bellied plovers make their way north along both the Atlantic and Pacific coasts. Many settle into the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to nest on the tundra. Here, a male circles overhead while giving its flight song. The plovers complete their breeding cycle in a month and a half. The parents build open nests on the ground where they lay and incubate four eggs. As soon as the young hatch, alert and covered with down, they follow their parents and begin foraging for insects on the tundra's low vegetation. Shortly after the summer solstice, the adult black-bellied plovers begin their southbound migration without their young. The juveniles won't follow for another month. And yet somehow, they know the route. even though they have never flown it before. Learn more about black-bellied plovers and other birds of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge at birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.